Bonjour. Donc bienvenue pour cette seconde journée et demie du colloque. Du colloque Un paysage global de Caen. Ce matin, nous avons le plaisir et l'honneur d'accueillir le professeur Saskia Sassen, qui nous a fait l'amitié de venir parler de son travail dans le cadre du colloque. Donc je vais, exercice un peu périlleux, tenter de faire une brève introduction pour vous présenter Saskia Sassen. C'est probablement totalement inutile, mais l'exercice m'y oblige et je suis ravie d'en avoir eu la charge. Juste pour aller très rapidement, donc Saskia Sassen est sociologue, bien sûr, elle est professeure à l'Université de Columbia. Et pour rentrer tout de suite dans le vif du sujet, il me semble que ce qu'on peut dire d'elle et de son travail en lien avec ce colloque, bien entendu, c'est que sa réflexion sur la territorialité et la mondialisation l'a emportée à travers des lieux et des espaces tout à fait spécifique, contrairement à une vision assez communément véhiculée de la mondialisation comme un processus de déterritorialisation. Et d'une certaine façon, Saskia Sassen s'est intéressée à la matérialité de la mondialisation, sa localisation, sa spatialisation, qui lui a permis de comprendre ou de proposer des interprétations nouvelles, des relations de pouvoir et des dynamiques sociales, notamment d'inclusion et d'exclusion, que cette mondialisation porte en elle. Et on peut dire que son travail est une des contributions les plus riches dans le champ de la sociologie, mais aussi dans d'autres champs, à l'interprétation de la globalisation comme un processus situé, comme un processus incarné, un processus qu'il faut analyser en donnant une attention tout à fait particulière aux choses et aux lieux. Et en ce sens, Saskia Sassen a réussi à être à la fois une sociologue, mais aussi une spécialiste d'économie politique et une anthropologue des petites choses et des grandes tendances ou des grandes questions. Et à ce titre, son travail me fait beaucoup penser à un livre de Charles Tilly, publié en 88, qui s'appelait « Big Structures, Large Processes and Huge Comparisons ». Et on retraçait ces grandes tendances qui ont déterminé l'émergence de l'État-nation, du capitalisme, etc., dans des périodes antérieures, bien sûr, puisque Tilly travaille plutôt sur le XVIIe, le XVIIIe et le XIXe siècle, mais à partir de processus empiriques, micro-analysés. Et ça, c'est un aspect de sa recherche que je trouve extrêmement intéressant et particulièrement pertinent pour nous, dans ce colloque, qui nous intéressons à des phénomènes empiriques et à la signification macroscopique, pourrait-on dire, de ces phénomènes très empiriques. Pour juste rendre grâce d'une certaine façon à ces différentes étapes de sa recherche jusqu'à présent, je vais aller beaucoup plus vite parce que là c'est sûrement quelque chose que vous connaissez aussi bien, sinon parfois mieux que moi. Saskia a commencé à travailler sur la mobilité dans les années 80, puisqu'elle a commencé ses grands travaux de recherche sur les déterminants de la migration et les relations entre les transferts de différentes formes de capital, notamment le capital financier, et la mobilité humaine. Et à ce titre, ce qui est intéressant, c'est qu'elle a été une des premières à faire un petit coin, entailler un petit peu les théories classiques de la relation entre développement et migration, l'idée que les migrations sont causées par le sous-développement et donc que si une région se développe, eh bien, il n'y a plus d'émigration de cette région. Et en fait, c'est assez faux, c'est empiriquement faux, et Saskia a été une des premières personnes à travailler sur ces questions et à se porter en faux contre ces représentations communes et erronées de l'économie politique de la migration. le travail de Saskia Sassen, qui est bien entendu le plus connu peut-être, c'est celui qui a touché aux villes globales, où elle a eu un impact sur la sociologie urbaine, mais aussi sur la sociologie de la mondialisation, sur la sociologie des flux financiers, absolument déterminant. Donc autour de son livre The Global City, qui a été réédité un nombre totalement incalculable de fois et traduit dans toutes les langues possibles. Et là, si vous voulez, ce qui est intéressant, encore une fois, par rapport à ce colloque, bien sûr, ce livre est extrêmement riche et je ne prétends pas le réduire à cette dimension, mais là encore, on retrouve dans son travail cette attention aux choses et aux lieux et le lien fait entre des microprocessus locaux qu'elle étudie dans le contexte de la sociologie urbaine inspirée par l'école de Chicago avec les grandes tendances de la mondialisation. Et cette démarche, cette méthode de travail me semble apporter quelque chose de, au-delà des conclusions du livre, me semble apporter quelque chose de particulièrement innovant dans la façon que l'on peut avoir d'observer la mondialisation. Et bien sûr, cette réflexion sur les choses, les lieux et les mobilités l'a amené dans un troisième temps, pourrait-on dire, de son travail de recherche, à réfléchir de manière peut-être un peu plus théorique, sur la question de la souveraineté, de l'autorité, du territoire. C'est effectivement un de ses ouvrages, Territory, Authority, Rights from Medieval to Global Assemblage, publié en 2006, qui a synthétisé cette dimension plus théorique de sa réflexion sur mondialisation et souveraineté. Et on y voit une forme d'aboutissement de son travail qui part des lieux, qui part des choses, qui part des individus, pour remettre en question de manière très architecturée en sens théorique, pour remettre en question l'idée d'une dénationalisation des processus politiques, sociaux, économiques à l'échelle globale. Donc elle, comme dirait Theda Scotchpole, elle bring the state back in, donc elle rapporte l'État dans les problématiques de globalisation, mais elle réintègre l'État dans cette interprétation de la globalisation d'une façon vraiment radicalement innovante. Donc je n'irai pas plus loin, je voudrais juste mentionner, souci aussi de rendre hommage au lieu dans lequel nous sommes, que Saskia s'est beaucoup intéressée à l'architecture, notamment l'architecture qui fait partie de la matérialité de la ville, de la matérialité de la mondialisation, et qu'elle a, en 2005, co-dirigé un livre qui s'appelle Digital Formations, New Architectures of Global Order, à Princeton University Press. Et son intérêt pour l'architecture l'a aussi amené à être impliqué dans la Biennale d'architecture de Venise en 2006 et à sortir, on va dire, du champ universitaire classique pour aller parler à d'autres champs intellectuels et professionnels. Et c'est aussi une des caractéristiques de son travail qui me semble importante de saluer. Donc, j'appelle donc le professeur Saskia Sassen pour sa conférence inaugurale.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you very much. That was wonderful. I suddenly was just installing myself and I was ready to listen to you. Why should I? Well, I'm terribly sorry that I could not participate in this great conference the first 2 days I was teaching, my teaching days, because I could have learned a lot. I've also, since some of the interactions with Michel Agier and Emily Traub, etc., via email, begun to understand to what extent this whole, if you want, the complexity of what we're calling, I don't know, a geography of camps, topologies of camps, how that fits actually quite interestingly in some of the work that I have been doing. So I'm not going to be trying to make a strong connection, but I will make a few, as I like to call them, experimental moves. That's a way of being prudent, if you want. Mais on me comprend l'anglais, oui? Tout le monde ici me comprend l'anglais? Parce qu'en français, ça, c'est trop long si je commence à parler en français. Mais quand même, le demande, etc., je peux faire en français. So back to English, which I also speak with a foreign accent, by the way. I don't speak one I speak six languages, not a single one with the perfect accent. That is an accomplishment of sorts, I think. I love interrupting myself. Now back to the story. So in the work that I want to talk about, I sort of conceptualize a few of my practices, research and interpretation practices, and you alluded very nicely to it already. And one of them is that I have a bit exposed, come to understand, that my site of investigation is, if you want, one way of putting it, is the fuzzy, the unstable edges of paradigmatic forms of knowledge. So in this, rather than say the center of paradigmatic knowledge, which tends to be the strongest, etc., I should say, as a big footnote, I need all the research that gets done, that is focused and that uses and develops the center, the stable, strong, you know, consequential center of paradigmatic knowledge. But in my own practice, I have then the luxury to position my inquiry in the fuzzy edge, the unstable edge. And I have come to realize, ex post, that I love being there in that unstable edge, right? So one of the effects of that, just to get at something that I want to end with, is if I take sufficient distance from the camps, I'm assuming that most people here are into camps, research or interpreting, etc. So if I take enough distance, you know, intellectual, methodological, etc., from the camps, what do I see? I see a formation that is, number one, a variable, clearly, and I think your book makes an extraordinary contribution to this. But at one end, I can stand back and say, why are they not allowed to become cities? Cities being complex but incomplete spaces, which enables the people living in them to be makers. And that's why cities keep reinventing themselves, they keep changing, they capture the particularities of an epoch, and they outlive formal closed systems of power, whether kingdoms, republics, multinational corporations, etc. And it also is the space, I argue, where those without power get to be makers. They make a history, they make a politics, they make a culture, they make a city, you know, in the case of the camp. Now, at this end, the camps are such spaces of misery and control that you cannot make that argument. But the point for me is not to go at the center, not at the paradigmatic meaning of camps, but to open up that variable and to say, you know what, at this end, not to mention the fact that so many of the people in displaced camps are never going back home. At what point do we stop calling them displaced people? And at what point do we have to say they are constituting a collectivity, a membership, a space, a city, whatever it might be? So that is sort of where I want to arrive at. But through to get there, I'm not really talking about camps. I'm just saying that camps fit as one instantiation of a much larger array of examples that I'm looking at. But so back to this methodological practice, and to do this kind of stuff, I sort of deploy what I call, where does this, or do I have to go up and down here? So I think of it as a space before method, and the space before method for me comes down to, if I materialize it, to analytic tactics, literally. the freedom to position yourself vis-à-vis your object of study in whatever way you want. No methodological constraints or disciplining. Now, eventually, I call it before method, because eventually I have to move back into that zone of method. You know, I cannot just stay there, you know, dancing my tangos in the before method zone. Now, three, oh, here we are. So here are some of these analytic tactics, and these are pretty core. They sort of function as core tactics, but I have a whole bunch of them, huh? Depending on what I'm after. So I want to emphasize it's a space of freedom, and I need it because I'm not in the center of the paradigm. I'm at the edge, and the edge is unstable. And so one of these is to actively destabilize stable meaning. So if I were doing research on camps, it would mean destabilizing actively the meaning of camps. Move myself back to such a far point that I have to rediscover what is a camp. And that opens you up to all the variabilities. That opens you up to projects, the projectual, that not simply that which is, but that which could be, right? So it is it really is an opening up. The second one concerns the stages, if you want, of powerful explanations. A powerful explanation is serious stuff. You can't just throw it out of the window. Sometimes I really want to do that, but you can't, clearly. But what you can do is ask, what does this powerful explanation keep me from seeing? So, for instance, cities, urbanization, those are very powerful terms. Immigration. They're so powerful that they're invitations not to think. You say it, immigration, city, urbanization. Just so much has been said just by those single words that they are invitations not to think. And I would have a question to camp researchers. To what extent using the language of camps also has that effect? You say a camp for displaced people, a refugee camp. How much has been covered by that language that all kinds of other things, like what I said at the beginning, the possibility of saying some of those camps could be cities if you didn't have these regulatory and policy and I don't know what all, you know, confinements, allow the residents to make a city, huh? That's what I was saying earlier. Now, one that really interests me a lot, and I'm working on that now again, is the question of territory. So I think of territory as a complex category that has embedded logics of power, which in our Western modernity achieved their most sort of developed form, if you want, in the national liberal state, and also embedded logics of power, of claim-making, which in our, again, Western modernity took the form of citizenship. But what happens when that understanding of territory captures less and less of what is territory? And to turn it around, putting it in another sense, what don't I see when I just invoke territory in that traditional sense, or that inherited sense almost? And so I'm very interested in analytically waking up. So réveiller, wake up, what I have to tell myself every morning, wake up. What happens when I make it work analytically, when I take it out, when I say that complex meaning, complex as it is not working analytically? If there's only one meaning, it is not working analytically. And so what happens if I allow it to work analytically? And so I in this little book that I'm working on now, I really want to ask myself the question, what do I see when I look at certain conditions as territories? Again, territory for me is not land, space, terrain, ground, all of that. It is this mixture. It is partly made. It is not simply a condition. And so I think of the global city as a kind of territory. I already said that in my work on that subject. It's a kind of territory, neither fully global nor fully national. Global city is not fully national. And I look at finance, high finance, and its particular terrains and grounds, and I say at some point, finance makes territory. It is a territory that is partly ensconced in nationally regulated spaces or enabling spaces, but formally enabling spaces. But it is also partly something that is something else, that is partly electronic, of course. So again, with camps, I would be very interested, and I think I would come up with this notion of a variable, clearly, that at one end, complex, diverse, incomplete, but with a systematicity that was made by the residents, and at the other end, spaces of deep misery and nothing happens, spaces of escape. Now, the making part, I've become very keen on capturing what is a partial approach, which is the making of it all. But I want to stretch it on to more sort of elusive terms, like I think we make inequality, we make justice, we make prisoners, mostly, certainly in the United States, we make them. You know, we have millions in jail. So it's not just those who are truly murderers, it's all kinds of other people. We probably also make refugees, we make camps, etc. Now, I, when I try to understand sort of these foundational conditions that are not fully captured in existing paradigms, I would argue, one kind of framing question that one can ask, that I like to ask when I give a talk like this, is what is the steam engine of our epoch? In other words, a powerful condition that makes itself present directly and indirectly throughout multiple systems, maybe not all. It's not a universal. It works itself and manifests in very, very specific ways, as the steam engine did. So it's, again, I repeat, it's not a universal condition. It's just a very sort of foundational one. The typical answer, by the way, is information technologies, which I think is a good answer. When I give people a chance to shout back and say what they think is the steam engine of our epoch, the typical answer is information technologies, which I can understand, I accept. But I argue partly in a contestatory mode, not necessarily on the substance, that it isn't that, that it is high finance, and again, understood as a steam engine. And so what finance, and I should make a separation here, between finance and traditional banking. So the traditional bank sells something it has. Money, old-fashioned money. They've gone a bit more beyond that, etc., but basically pretty close. Finance sells something it does not have. And in that selling, what it does not have lies its creativity, its complexity, and its danger. Because it has to develop extraordinary instruments that have nothing to do with microeconomics, by the way, that are the math of physicists, those who track what cannot be known. And to have those complex instruments, it hires brilliant minds who sit there developing, solving the technical problem, you know, as they did with the atomic bomb. And on the other hand, it needs to invade other sectors. So put those two together, we're talking very powerful category and one that is enormously dangerous and enormously destructive. The steam engine had some positives. High finance, very few, certainly the way it has conducted itself in the last 20 years. Now, here's an example of what I mean by capability. And I hope this works, the pointer. I just want to point out, here it was less than a trillion. You don't need to know the details. This is a key instrument, it doesn't matter. Less than a trillion. I don't know, en français, on dit ça, pas trillion, no? Well, the zeros, I'm talking about even more zeros. This is finance, after all. So this was less than a trillion in 2001. 6 years later, highest point 2007, it was 62 trillion. 62 trillion at that point was more than the global GDP of all the countries in the world. That's an achievement. Plus, secondly, it was only 10% of total value of finance as measured by outstanding derivatives, which is the basic measure. We're talking capability. So we call it money. The value now of this, well, before this little crisis that we have now, was a quadrillion. That is even more zeros. Je ne sais pas comment on dit ça. Quadrillion, on dit pas ça, non? On dit quadrillion? Ça, c'était très efficace, mais pas. Alors, now I am talking about this because I really mean to talk about it as the steam engine, something with a capacity to profoundly alter even stuff that is not at all directly related. Now, in my mind, if I were working in camps, I would try to understand, are some of the displacements, some of the evictions, etc., also feeding? Is war, you know, I don't know that I would want to connect it to finance, but I would want to connect it to the fact that there is a capacity, a systemic capacity, that can expel, that can destroy, that can eliminate. That is what is the issue here. Now, here is an example. It's a familiar example. I don't want to dwell on it. But this is a very good example of how finance used very modest assets to destroy whole communities. We are, again, you can read this. You know, I don't want to dwell too much on this subject now. But this is what I want to dwell on. These are the expulsions in the north. And they're also happening in Europe. So what we, and the basic data, I should say, comes from the Federal Reserve, which is the central bank of the United States. They are a great research website. If you are interested in all kinds of stuff, good and bad about the United States, by all means, go to the central bank websites. Besides making policy, which is often very destructive, they're really a great data and research entity. Many people don't seem to know that about central banks. I assume the French central bank is that too. But anyhow, the head of the Fed, Bernanke, the former head, when he retired just a few months ago, he said almost 14 million households will lose their home by the time this is done. Now, 14 million households can be up to 30 million individuals. It's probably more. We have whole new homeless encampments in the United States. The biggest one right now in the United States in the last few years is in Silicon Valley. And I have a video. And you, if you look very carefully, yes, they are homeless. They're building, you know, tents and whatever with tarp. They have very good sneakers, high-quality sneakers. And they have very good bikes. They've hung on to those two things, many of these young people. You know that they were middle class. They were this new professional ascendant. You know, they were just becoming out. I mentioned that to juxtapose to these other expulsions that we're so used about, the miseries of the world, the people who live in total misery. Well, these people are not quite living in total misery, but they are homeless and they are jobless. And years after years of that, it's now been about 5 years, you know, it does erode. Now, the second notion is that this does not happen in Europe. So I just want to, these are just, in the book I have sort of the full, I think I have it, or in appendix, the full list of all the countries. I want to point out that among the highest foreclosure rates is Germany, supposedly the country that got it all right, right? And so now this is every year. Now this accumulates, you understand. This is not every year, it is this year it was 91 plus, then 88 plus 86,000, etc. Hungary is the worst. Hungary being that country in Eastern Europe that was the most open to the global financial circuit, etc. Some of you probably know that, right? So Hungary now has 1 million people plus out of their homes. When these people leave, in the United States that's also the case, in their full materiality, they're invisible. They become invisible to the statistical eye eventually. We capture them now when the law puts them out of their houses. But then we lose them. We don't see them. It's like with displaced people too. At some point we forget that they are there, you know. We have statistics, etc. And now we have Michel Agier's book, which is great. So, and then you see that it's everywhere. Even the darling, supposedly Denmark and Netherlands, a bit less of a darling, you know, the good countries of Northern Europe, you also have it there. Very small numbers, but it's happening. And it's just, it's not going to decline, these numbers. These numbers, if anything, are going to grow. Now, I want to focus on one little thing. Don't get disturbed by all the numbers, okay? They're very simple numbers, and I'm just going to point out a few. I just want to look at the bridge that finance, as steam engine, has built into even the most modest households. Because it's not just about the rich. That is why it's so dangerous. If it's just about the rich, let them wreck each other. Destroy. Wreck means destroy. No. It can deal with anything. Student loans. You know, anything. Yeah. So debt. And I just invite you to look at this ratio of household credit, this title, to personal disposable income. Credit is debt. Credit sounds pretty. It's there to spend. It's debt. Now, here are some examples. By the way, these are critical years. These are the years that, you know, and then you have a whole other phase after this 2005. So this is a very short, brutal history, 2005. Look at Hungary. Very reasonable amount of debt in each household, right? 11%. Only 5 years later, almost 40%. That's pretty fast. Now, in the meantime, the United States was already over 100% and proudly became 132%. Now, where is France? France, terribly reasonable. Look at that. You don't take debt in this country, clearly. 57, 57, 58, you know, basically. It seems like Germany, 70, 70, 70. So that is, but, you know, several of these other countries that just enter the circuit. Now, again, these kinds of increases in debt are one signal, one indicator, you know, something is not going to be going well for some of these households. The question then for me also is, I go digging into the IMF staff papers, which are great, again, another great set of data. Who owns the debt? If the debt is owned by a little local bank, the capacity of that household to take a loan and to pay interest recirculates in that little town. So it matters who owns it. Well, in the case of Hungary, 40% is owned by foreign banks. They're big banks. So they take it out. Austrian, Swiss, Germans are the dominant ones. Now, here are some curves that, and I like these line graphs because they give you, they tell a tale rather than looking at all the numbers, right? And so this is corporate profits after tax in the United States. This is the most extreme case, probably. Here, all kinds of stuff is happening, but it's measured in billions. That is why it shows a flat line. It's not that they were not making any profits. Now look, they go, then they go, and then they have a half-hour crisis, right, in 29. I exaggerate, of course, it's about 2 years. And then they go even higher. That's an accomplishment. Very severe crises. All these people are losing their homes. All kinds of bad things are happening. Small firms are going broke. Little owners are committing suicide in Greece. But here they make even more. That's a capacity, that's a capability at work. And clearly, you know, for their own interest. Here, I am very amused by these data. You must bear with me, okay? I am totally entertained by these numbers. Anyhow, here's corporate assets in the United States. They didn't even reflect the crisis. So we are dealing with systematicities that are really going in opposite directions. On the one hand, even ex-Silicon Valley employees are homeless. Millions of people are being thrown out of their homes in developed countries. So you get sort of the picture, right? And now here in the meantime, our governments are all getting also more indebted, with few exceptions, even Germany. But now here are graphs on inequality that I don't want to deal with, but I'm going to leave my slides so that people can look at them. Because what is really extraordinary, what I want to capture, this to me is a beautiful graph I tell my students you should have this engraved in your mind. 100 years of inequality as represented by one particular trend. What it shows you that were the Keynesian years, it sort of we managed a bit to reduce concentration at the top. That is what that graph indirectly tells you. Loss of ground from 47 to 33. 33% is still a very robust. This is just earnings, this is not inherited wealth. And then before you knew it, we were back up. When you read the literature of this period, this also holds for Europe, by the way, you read sentences like, now that we have discovered the way in which we can have a strong middle class, a strong prosperous working class, we're never going to let go of that. Well, before you knew it, 1987, etc., it went up again. I don't know if people are totally with me. I'm jumping very fast, but I'm assuming that some of this is familiar. And this is yet another version of something very interesting. 30 years, this ends in the current census. Almost 50%, no growth at all. And when I ask myself, what allowed the commentators, not the researchers, the commentators to keep on saying everything is going so well that they were just seeing the effects of this and not this. I think particularly of cities and the gentrification, the redoing. Remember, Paris was poor, New York was poor, London was poor. These cities were all poor in the 1960s, in the 1970s, into the 1980s. And then they take off. So if you were one of those very smart people who picks it up immediately, who knows a bit of this, a bit of that, and you walk through those cities, you said, wow, these are good times for everybody. Because more and more parts of the city were just beautiful. Well, in the meantime, you have this invisible history, again, in its full materiality, it becomes invisible, including, of course, the modest middle-class people still living in their same homes, but behind the walls that look, the facades may look the same. The question is, what happens behind those facades? Behind those facades, there is doubling up, there is poverty, etc. So there is, to me here, a transversal sort of methodological and interpretation issue, which is how, what do we see and what don't we see, even if it is fully material? And I must say again as a footnote that when I think about camps, there is a dominant sort of material representation. And I then immediately, almost as a sort of methodological move, want to know in all the materiality of those camps, you know, that is sort of accessible through great photography, etc., what don't we see? And one question I have, it's not more misery that we don't see. I want to see something else. I want to see, under what conditions can camp inhabitants become makers? And the extreme version, as I said at the beginning, would be makers of a city, that kind of space, where they can be makers, etc., etc. I don't want to repeat what I said earlier. Now, here are other versions of this extreme. And the reason I'm showing this is that I'm saying that it is quite possible that much of what has been said for the extreme visible conditions, displaced people, refugees, etc., is, systemically speaking, even though not in the full sense of policy making and the categories of analysis and the classifications, totally different. But in what sense are these not also trends that mark expulsions from existing arrangements of more and more people? And to what extent are we seeing something in the global north that we don't associate at all with displaced people and refugee camps, but that they are a systemic equivalent? And in this little book of mine, I emphasize, you know, again, at the edge, the extreme condition, the expelled. All of what I'm describing, ultimately, are things that affect, in the most extreme version, a minority of people. So it is for displaced people and refugees, but it's an extreme condition. It's a condition that must be acknowledged. I mean, I know that in some cases, like the Palestinian case, you know, it's not just simply a minority, it's a more complex superstructure that is involved as well. But anyhow, here you see that we have always had inequality and concentration of wealth, right? But look at that, the two, after the crisis, you see, more concentration at the top, which suggests again this sort of opening up. Oh dear. And then here's another version of it, actually loss of wealth. When you take the medium, when you take the center of the paradigm, you don't pick up on this. You don't pick up on this fact. This is a very elementary illustration of this methodological point that I was trying to make at the beginning. Now, all kinds of other trends. What I found very interesting, I have a lot of data on people who are leaving, migrants who are leaving Europe. And so here is a graph. In this case, it's about Spain, out-migration from Spain by continent of origin. So look at all of these. The only ones where you have barely a change, they all are leaving. Yeah? That, to me, these are interesting trends. They tell larger stories. The only ones that are here is Oceania. Maybe that's pretty far away, I guess, when you're in Spain, right? But even Asia, I mean, look at that. They're just leaving. Now, we know that part of Spain is in deep crisis. Part of Spain is still making a lot of money. So there is something to be explained here. Why is it that so many people are leaving? Now, where they go is another matter. We can't dwell on that now. But it is very interesting. One of the highest groups is the Europeans. They're leaving Spain, other Europeans. Now, we know that many of the Latin Americans are going to Latin America because it's good, but Latin America is also declining. If I must think of what would the algorithm of what's happening in our developed economies telling us, it's pretty bad. It is really a bifurcation. The most dramatic image I can think of is a geography of wealth and advantage that includes parts of Angola, that includes part of countries where you have vast numbers of poor people. Partial, tight geographies, not the imperial mode of older. Britain wanted the whole of Africa. Spain wanted the whole of Latin America. Not now, just parts. Just take what you need. The rest doesn't matter. So when you take that kind of view, you know, many possibilities there. Now, one instance of how what gets measured as development positively can actually have, again, one of these bad effects, if you want, that I would think of in the term of expulsions. So this is the land grabs. I'm sure many of you know about this. And my invitation is to think, what happens when a country buys 2.8 million hectares, I'm referring to particular cases here, 2.8 million hectares of land in Congo and 200.5 or whatever in Zambia to make a plantation for biofuels. You expel floras, faunas, so you reduce the complexity of the biosphere, number one. It means you make land more fragile. You can use it for a while, exploit it, but eventually you're killing it, right? And then you expel rural cultures of economy, rural genealogies of meaning, rural modes of survival that are often complex. They may be poor, but they are complex. Out. And then finally, where do those people go? They go to cities. So when I hear the term urbanization, I immediately must ask, what am I not seeing when I say urbanization? You know, all these politicians, no matter what they know one sentence: most people live in cities. The question is also, how does that get constituted? How does it get made? Where are these people come from? So here are some very quick figures. I'm sure some of you are familiar. This is also all in the book of some of this. Mind you, Europe is also mostly in Eastern and Central Europe, but also in France. In France, all kinds of young sons and daughters of former farmers think that, well, maybe I should go try to get a job on a farm. I mean, buy land and become a farmer. That's what I meant, actually. They can't buy land. It's been bought up. So in England also you have foreigners buying not just urban land but also. So there are massive processes underway that are destabilizing sort of more, if you want, complex notions of membership. This is my land, this is my country, I'll be fine. Here is the other issue is, of course, that most of the land is for biofuels, which means you can put all the pesticides you want, all the fertilizers. So it poisons vast stretches of land that go beyond the plantation, water bodies, etc. Again, another source for people having to leave the country. A lot of what we call immigration today is an expulsion. And this has been picked up in those who argue about how the eco situation, you know, the changing climate desertification is producing these kinds of immigrants. Now, I can talk forever, so somebody at some point has to indicate to me when I should start, because I moreover get totally carried away by this stuff. I just want to also, because this is the larger operational space, in my view, that we've got to take into account. We've got to deal with land and with water. So the social science is too narrow. To me, that is also in the fuzzy edges. I think a lot of the paradigmatic elements that we sort of use could also move into that. They have a bit of difficulty, but they could. Now, this is something that has gone a bit beyond the radar screen. And that is that a lot of land that still looks like it's alive is barely alive. And the famous, as they call it in the United States, the bread basket, you know, of the, I don't know, of the world, probably they say, the top of it looks very green and beautiful when it's, you know, the time to be green, but the temperature beneath it has been going hotter and hotter. It's dying, but it's not visible yet. And so, you know, this again is a story that repeats itself in other scales. So here you can see some of these data. Now, the other thing is just in general, the question of heating. Each one of these lines, and there are many more, reflects a particular scientific trajectory to measure. They have enormous debates among themselves, and you have to measure it this way and that way, but it all goes up, right? So, fine, I love that they have all these debates. It's actually reassuring. And all these different measures, slightly different curves, but it goes up. Here are all the areas right now in the world where water is already limiting agricultural production. And the United States is one of them. Certain parts of Europe, too. These are universal conditions that go well beyond whether highly developed or less developed, but clearly the poorer countries are going to be suffering more. And this is, again, the level rise. Many different measures, but we know that is happening. Another constraint that is going to create more expulsions, I would say. Now, on the other hand, just as a footnote, this is a footnote. If we implemented all the policy measures we have right now, I emphasize policy, it would make almost no difference. This would be the line. In other words, the space of policy, and I find that more and more, is not going to solve the problem. Nor is the space of policy, as in government policy, going to solve some of these expulsions that I'm talking and the growing potential for expulsions that we're talking about. We've got to exit. So in the work that I'm doing now on cities and the environment, I'm looking at all kinds of biospheric capacities, sort of work that biologists are doing. Cities, every wall, every surface, every movement should be working for the environment. Every time I speak, every time I walk in my house, I'm generating energy. Every time we walk on the streets, there should be sensors. We have so many technologies. So I'm sort of in this person who wants to connect technology, certain kind of technology, with biospheric capacities. You all know probably about how bacteria and algae are simply fantastic to replace what we now do with plastic. So anyhow, this, to me, all hangs together, that this environmental destruction needs to be addressed on a far more foundational level than this policy level. If we don't, we're going to have more expulsions and a whole new generation of camps for the displaced, given how the powerful sector is going. Now, I want to conclude now and sort of invoke the meaning the category of unstable meanings. I remember at the beginning I talked about that. The need also to actively destabilize So, as I say here, you already read that, you know, all these expulsions that I'm talking about. So one of them for me really is membership in a nation state. You know, what does it really mean when you have these, what I alluded to 5 minutes ago or so, these new geographies of concentration that cut across divides, that connect the privileged in many different parts of the world, overriding long-established divides like north, south, east, west, etc. And then with the camp, sort of to anchor a lot of what I've said in an analytic way rather than the particular contents in this question of camps. And at the extreme, I said, should they be allowed to become cities? And by that I mean that the residents make them into cities. And I should say that the city, when I work on the city, I can't say the city's a city. I've got to, as I alluded to in the beginning, remove myself sufficiently that I'm in a zone where it could be many things, including a city. So I say the city is a complex but incomplete space. Huh? And in that mixture, it can keep reinventing itself, et cetera, et cetera. And the question of indeterminacy to me is critical if you have a city. So if you have density as your criteria for a city, to me that is a mistake. Because a huge office park, which is just office after office after office building, is not a city. It has no indeterminacy, and it is closed rather than incomplete. I would say the same thing for a housing place, you know, which have one housing tower after the other. You have enormous density. It is not a city. And so for me, the question then, if I extend that to some of these more complex camps, you know, they have the density question very often. And so to me, the typical sort of measures that are sometimes used for saying this is a city or for assuming it is a city, to me, that doesn't work analytically. I mean, you know, if it doesn't matter, of course, that's fine. You can use density. But if I'm really trying to understand something, I really have to go, as I like to say, to the non-X. If I'm interested in a particular X, go to the non-X. And so the whole question of the camps, it has me quite intrigued, and I'm trying to figure out what is the non-X for the camp. Because I cannot say a camp for the displaced is a camp for the displaced. That just doesn't work for me analytically. If I really care, it doesn't work. If I don't care, hey, it works. You know, who cares? But and so this question clearly, if I think of the camp, one thing is indeterminacy probably is not there, except if ultimate misery is a kind of indeterminacy. I don't know that. That's a question probably also for philosophers. And then this other element here, space, is to me one of the markers of a city as opposed to an office park or a housing park, is that the powerless get to make a history, a culture, even if they do not get empowered. In the Anglo tradition, the notion is you lack power. If something happens that makes a difference, you're empowered. I'm precisely interested in that huge, vague zone, which is between being simply elementary disempowered and empowered. Empowered is fine. I don't care that much. I'm not intrigued. But I'm intrigued by what happens in this shadowy domain. Huh? And in that sense, the camp, a complex camp, a camp that has had more than one generation, possibly two generations, etc., is actually an interesting indeterminate space which might have potentials. Again, I repeat, not the camps that are simply spaces of misery and illness. What would happen in such a, and to me that is a kind of thinking aloud in conversation I like to have over dinner with good wine, you know, not in a seminar room. I'm not ready for that. But it is a mode of thinking about it. Now, I wanted to end with this map. How many of you have seen this map? It's in the public domain. I never show stuff that is not in the public domain. I work with stuff that is not in the public domain, but I would never presentable. Anyhow, these are 10,000 buildings plus that are full-time data gathering about all of us who are in the U.S. Nationality is secondary, okay? Everybody, all the data. My university has the right to read my email. I know they don't. Our president is a legal scholar who has defended, you know, certain rights of people. He's good. But they have the right to do that. So many of my colleagues don't use university mail anymore because, you know, just like that, just as an act of opposition. Now, I want to point out a couple of things about this. These are huge buildings. They're invisible. We can be standing in front of them. All we see is a structure, but we don't know. This map has been in the public domain since 2010. Most people I speak with in the United States have not seen it. When I was showing this before Mr. Snowden, people couldn't react. When I explained what it was, they couldn't react. There was no narrative. There was no... And so this is, to me, a very... I'm just using this now a bit as an illustration. This is a very important fact to me, that we need theory to see. You know, theoria, of course, in Greek is seeing not with this eye, but with another eye. And a lot of what I work in, this sort of what I could say are the spaces of the expelled, is invisible. Because we don't measure it, we don't know it, we reduce it to something very elementary. In that sense, doing this great project on camps is a major contribution, because it gets to something that we think of as simple, elementary, it's all the same, why should we bother? Like, same thing has happened with slums. They used to be seen, a slum is a slum. Well, now we know, no, it's a variable, right? And so, to me, it is very intriguing that what we don't see, you know, again, so I would say Agier's book is a contribution to us seeing something about camps, etc., as is the research of people doing that. Now, just to emphasize this question, this is just one area where there's a lot of this building, which is Washington, D.C., of course, the capital of the country. And as you can see, in Washington and surrounding area, 33 building complexes for top secret intelligence work are under construction or have been built since September 2001. That is a lot of big buildings. Together, they occupy about 17 million square feet. That's a lot. The equivalent of almost three pentagons. That's a lot. Or, and here is the irony, 22 US Capitol buildings. Capitol being the house of democracy. So I want to end with a provocation, which is a framing that affects not just the thing itself that I say in this little phrase, but just a mode of thinking, a mode of relating. And in this case, it would be, poor people in the camps. And so I ask, who are we, the citizens? Who are we today? And legally speaking, I don't know if you know this, but we are mostly losing rights. We're gaining some on the gay front and all of that. But we're mostly losing rights. Corporations are gaining rights. And if we sign the new trade treaties, they gain more rights. They gain the right to their own private justice if they don't like what the state tells them. So it's even worse than WTO. So the question really is, who are we, the citizens? And hence, what I'm trying to get at, that which we think are the camps out there in the world, well, we have it right there in Silicon Valley also, in a version of it, a version. These are all different. So one methodological move is the need to go to ground level to exit existing theorizations so that we can see something that we don't see with these existing theorizations. So putting a lot of these things that I described for the global north on the same ground as the camps, and I include here also prisons. In the book, I make a comparison about prisons, especially United States, that kind of prison, which is serious stuff, prisons and camps, and displaced people camps. Anyhow, I now have to smile, though I just gave you all these negatives, but thank you very much for your attention.
Il y a une question là. Est-ce qu'il y a d'autres questions? On fait deux questions. Personne n'ose lever le.
En français ou non? In English? In French?
Yeah, whatever, whatever. If I don't understand it in French, then I will ask you to say it in English.
Saskia, thank you very much for this. On dit conférence en français for the speech. J'ai deux questions qui sont sur la page qui était laissée pour la conversation pour une soirée et pas pour une conférence.
Et thank you for picking up on that.
Yes, let's go.
Yes.
Membership of a nation state. Mm. Précisément, I think that what you said about global economy as desnationalization, denationalization of a part of national economy. Mm-hmm. I wonder if we cannot say that all these outside, tout ce dehors, all these spaces are not this kind. That means the membership or citizenship in a non-state or in a desnationalization of national state.
Yeah.
And the other question, very quickly. the idea of a camp city, I don't know if it refers to a city or if it refers to le droit à la ville. I mean, it's an occupation, a movement, something that people are alive and they say this place is ours and we will make something. And this making, we don't know, it's full of undetermination, we don't know what will happen. But isn't this the movement that makes the city,
mm-hmm.
the right to
and
the city?
And what is the question? Oh, that makes the right to the city.
What about the occupation?
Right.
Occupation, the making the city is a kind of occupation of a space, this is the beginning of a city.
Yeah. Let me start with that second point that you just made. So I think that... Yeah, and when I say, you know, the city, I mean, I am also thinking, I know from New York, for instance, particular immigrant communities, artists communities who may or may not be immigrants. So it's not the city, huh? It's very particular interventions. And one issue that is emerging as critical is the need to protect indeterminacy in the city. We have too many well-wishing, nice politicians who say, oh, let's clean this all up and make one big, whatever, you know, mega center. Well, that eliminates indeterminacy. You know, the rebuilding of Potsdamer Platz has eliminated indeterminacy. Those are private streets, right, in Potsdamer Platz. You know what I'm talking about, right? And I did two articles that are sort of connected to this. So one is called, I'm just giving the titles because one is called Does the City Have Speech? Now, speech in English is sort of a category that has weight, Sprache. It doesn't mean does it chatter. It's also a legal category. So corporations in the United States now have political speech. They can give money to politicians that they like, and they're doing that in the billions. Huh? They have speech. So I argue that the materiality itself, the complexity, and that is why complex but incomplete matters, that is why indeterminacy matters, and that is why we can be makers in a city which we cannot on a plantation and we cannot really in an office, you know, park, as they call that. And so I think that the city has speech. She talks back. We don't know the language anymore. Huh? And this other piece that I just wrote is called Who Owns the City? And I'm seriously doing research about the vast amount of land, city land, that is being bought up, for good or for bad. I want to keep it a bit neutral. You know, some of these might be good projects. Mostly they're not. So just to give you an example, and these are things that people have not focused on. The focus is, of course, on some famous foreign buyers who buy some buildings. But I say when China's construction company buys a huge stretch of land that we have in Brooklyn, which used to be sort of industrial space. Huge, not to hit on China, by the way, huh, because all kinds of other. And it's going to build 14 huge apartment buildings in a space that used to be sort of a mixed, low-use community space, etc. I mean, they're buying a piece of New York City. They're not just simply buying buildings, they're buying, so in that sense, who owns the land? So I think that cities are in trouble. That thing that I love, which is cityness, it's in trouble. And I'm trying to sort of, you know, but I think you are right that being a maker in the city, even if it's in particular neighborhoods, you know, forget about the corporate center, and that Occupy movements, etc., those are all ways also of enacting the right to the city and probably developing instrumentality. So now I have a big deal about if a big buyer comes and says, I'll buy this whole piece of land and eliminates little streets, little parks, little... It's just, it should be a no-go. We're having a big meeting in India about all of this, because India, you know, is a place where they are just buying up, making them into businesses. Parts of the city become business. You in continental Europe, it still is a more civilized situation. But on the first one, I think I agree with what you said. Was there a particular, because it was sort of what I had said, or was there a particular issue in that first part of your question that you wanted to, that I missed maybe? I know the state, the denationalizing, right, the denationalizing. Right. Right. Yeah. So I developed this category of denationalizing, by which I don't mean necessarily privatization, by the way, but as a kind of way of capturing what is a growing trend, which is that one way of putting it is the making of parts of a global operational space inside, and I would say parts, inside national states. So finance does that in one way, but I also argue that entities like the IMF and the WTO have made that inside the executive branch of government. And I say that happens in France, and it happens in Germany, it happens all over, right? And but it is a variable, because I also know that poor Filipino immigrants, women, who are really all over the world, the Filipinas, are organizing anti-trafficking networks, and they are also creating a global operational space for themselves that is, you know, that sort of instantiates, if you want, partly in several countries. But you know why Filipino women are in so many problems? Because the Catholic Church has been a great enabler, besides the government being in the export industry of its own workers. I think that I'm beginning to go back to those. Those are things that I developed in my territory book, and that is really my best book, I think, and I'm still feeding off it, you know. Now, my question, I have to stop talking. You realize I could be on this podium for 7 hours and just talk.
Just one more question.
My question.
We might take two, but really...
But maybe there are no questions, right?
Many questions.
Just thank you.
Catherine, yes, hello.
Saskia. I wanted to start from what you said, which is very interesting for our topic. What we measure as development is actually massive expulsion. Yeah. I think it is very interesting for our reflection of camps, but also on citizenship, because now we are creating people we are unable to name, unable to consider as citizens, and which... kind of citizenship do you imagine for people who are now in this global process of the world, but we are unable to understand really to what extent can be this process, and how can we name these people? Citizens, mobile people, people, stateless people, we try to hide them. We right. don't want to speak about them. So it is a world mm. concern.
Yeah. But you see, you probably know already some of this because I have talked probably about it with you already. But see, that is why I like to start when I deal with immigrants, refugees, undocumented immigrants, etc. I like to start with saying, who are we? Right? And if we differentiate ourselves too much from the weaker and more vulnerable, we're missing a big piece of history in the making. That's one thing. The other thing, the other extreme, I've really looked with great care of how elites that are part of, an elite is not simply a rich person, right? You have a formation, there is social formation. How much do they really care about citizenship? You know, there are all kinds of instruments right now that means that they don't even need citizenship to do a whole lot of stuff that they're doing in many different countries. And I think that is also very interesting. You know, so what I see in this moment right now is a devaluing of citizenship. Now, by citizenship, I also, if I remove myself enough so that I'm not talking citizenship, I say it's an incompletely theorized contract between the state and subjects. You know, whatever the subjects might be, it might be the immigrant, the legal immigrant regime, it might be the elites who come and the professionals who come on special visas and WTO mode 4, you know, which enables movements of people, you probably know all of that. Anyhow, and then when I then take enough distance that I can put a lot of different stuff, you know, on the same table, ground level, no matter all their complex differences, ground level, de-theorize them all, on the street, all of them, one after the other. I love that image. The elites, And then I say, okay, who's the citizen? And if I'm losing so many rights, because we're really losing technical rights, remember that in our Western law, the citizen does not exist like, say, a Christmas tree with all the baubles. I say, oh, I lost a right. No, we don't exist as such. We exist via a whole bunch of technical systems that constitute little bits and pieces, very difficult for your average journalist, for your average citizen, and for your average researcher to understand when we're losing rights, you see. And that, to me, is also part of the story. So when you look at it that way, and you add incompletely theorized contract with the state, you know, it just opens up the whole domain. And to me, citizenship is right now an unstable meaning, I must tell you. So is immigration, by the way, because I think more and more immigrants are refugees from environmental, etc., or expelled in one way or another. And the refugee regime is not capturing all of them, the formal refugee regime. So I think Catherine, that we have entered an epoch where we really need to do some very serious thinking, and I know many people, and you are certainly in a vanguard in all of that, but I, in my own way, I have this transfer. I'm not an expert on immigration. I just think that it is a foundational category, etc., etc. But I do think it's unstable. You see, and when you see of high levels of unemployment, when you see of shrinking, just take the good European countries, shrinking benefits, etc., etc., you stand back and you say, well, you know, what is this? Now, in Brazil, sure, the poor have gained some rights, but that's also very limited. You know, there is variability around. I don't want to just talk about the privilege in Europe. Mind you, we are still very well off. I'm trying to make an argument to wake up the comfort, the people who are in the comfort zone, who think, I'm fine. I don't need to worry. You know, sort of that, and the middle classes are, the impoverishment of the middle classes are the best example of that. Now, I know that I have to shut up now. Right?
We have actually two people.
Okay, then why don't you ask the questions? Because then I try to make a short answer.
Catherine from University of Beirut and Alessandro Petit for like 10 seconds.
Alessandro, there you are. Look at that, yes.
Yes, hello. In anecdotal level, I notice a lot of figures you brought from IMF or World Bank. How come?
IMF staff papers. Very different from the same thing with the World Bank.
I am talking about at least raw materials you brought, and so in my project on knowledge production in the Arab world, I study poverty and social inequality as topic. 200 articles analyzed. What is amazing, most of them is funded by World Bank, and they are extremely conservative. It means that mapping poverty, there is no rooted cause of social inequality and things like that. So maybe this is a beautiful example of World Bank work on global and in local. And there is two different logics.
Maybe I'd just like to come back to your question, why the camp cannot be transformed into the city. And maybe inviting you to, because you proposed this very interesting methodological approach, it was maybe in that sense to think the idea of normalization.
The what?
The normalization. Because normalization. This would be the problem, you know, in the case in which we might think and how the community will perceive the fact that still majority of people will refuse to become normal citizen, and this goes back also to what you just said about citizenship, because you know what does it mean that to become that you know citizen, and therefore how you would in this case you start to think how it's possible to destabilize the idea of normalization, which imply the fact that as if becoming a citizen today is just something which is clear, because I think what is interesting about the refusing. In an act of not normalizing the camp is a way of actually trying to redefine what does it mean to be the citizen.
It of dignifying, you said?
What not to redefine.
To
what is
reify what it means to
making
be the citizen.
A new definition
I see.
In a sense. So okay. That in a way also link a little bit yeah,
right.
The refugees with the idea of right. Citizens. So where you will start on destabilizing normalization.
Right. I didn't use the language of normalize, because I used the language of making a city out of a camp, not a third party who comes and normalizes. That's a bit different, right? Because we all know that, so the Palestinian situation also, you know, that some refuse to abandon the status of refugees because they lose certain, and others want, right? But the normalizing function is a function that sounds like it comes from the outside. Making a city out of a camp is a different project for me, and it is about people being makers. And global bureaucracies not enabling that, not allowing that. And again, I'm talking about a variable, right? Now, I think that at the heart of your question, even if I exited the little framing, is then, to use my language a bit, if I may, that making makes you a citizen. I mean, that is, you know, in Western Europe, in the glorious little century, 90 years, we know it lasted, when hundreds of cities were built, mostly illegal. They were illegal settlements, right, Middle Ages. They were built on rough terrains, high up, low down, because that land was, nobody cared. That was terra nullius, you know? Deep inside Europe, so to speak, they became makers. They made urban law. And this is another thing that I'm working at, is, and that comes back to this, these spaces within. We need to make urban law, constitutive urban law, not simply governance. I'm so tired of the language of governance. I simply don't want to use it anymore at all. But constitutive law, and in that sense, constituting, and maybe this is one way of answering your question, constituting a complex space where its inhabitants are recognized as makers. Without them, you don't have that space. There is not a third, you know, there always is a third authorizer, mind you, in this case, a national state or whatever it might be. But so that is, I don't have a full, you raise a complex process also question, it's not a decision, huh? It has to be. So I don't know if I'm beginning to answer your question, Alessandro, but it seems to me that thinking of people as constitutive. The city is constituted through its people. And if you privatize vast stretches of it, to take a very Western, Northwestern example, then you have lost something. Huh? Whereas the constitutive person, mind you, those medieval cities qualify, we all know they also had slaves and women who were not constitutive actors, we all know that. But still, I want to just capture that notion of constitutive urban law. And constitutive law for a whole variety, I extend that argument, constitutive law for all kinds of formations. There are other formations that we haven't talked about that I also care about. So anyhow, now, you know, there are two things in my answer to your question, and I'm very amused because I rarely get asked this, you know. So one thing is the staff papers is often stuff that does not get published. That's why they are listed as IMF staff papers. And they often have some very good critical analyses that may not feed easily, though they could be made to fit, but not easily into the standard programmatics, you know, etc. So that is one issue with the IMF. But I also use central banks. I think I mentioned it, right? Central banks are great data resources. But you have to really go digging, and it's in the public domain because we, the citizens, pay for that, for central banks' data. Huh? That's different from the policy function. Huh? And so I really go to those sources because they have enormous resources and they offer cover vast. I've been doing that kind of stuff. It's like counter, you know, oh, IMF, I don't want to touch the data. Oh, World Bank. Hell yes, go, but go digging. Don't stay on the surface. The World Bank, actually, if you've been there, has a lot of people who do great research. But that stuff rarely winds up in the formal papers. So that's one kind of answer. So yes, I want to look at those data. But I also use, you know, your average sort of anthropological, academic sort of data. Huh? But that is, I'm not religious. So yeah, I use the data. Contaminated data by the power of the institution. Yeah, but I use it because it's good. Same thing about the Federal Reserve. I have such good data that is scandalous stuff. You know, our Fed, I mean, just to give you an example, $17 trillion. So there was a loan to the bank during the crisis that was $320 billion. Billion is less than trillion, huh? Less zeros, billion. And that was public debate. And behind the backs, in the privacy of the Fed, $17 trillion for 21,000 requests. That was our citizens' money. And that, you know, nobody paid attention to that, except the Financial Times. They actually, you know, so I think we really need to say, okay, where's the good data? I put it all, again, at ground level, and let me go check it out. You know, I'm not going to say no if there is a, you know, anyhow. Anyhow, it was a pleasure, and thank you for all the time, really.